This is Bad Movies We Love, part of the Scheist Podcast Network.
If you're listening to this, you are the Resistance.
Hello, bad movie lovers, and welcome to a very special spotlight session here on Bad Movies We Love, where we don't just talk about the movies, we talk to the people who make them. I've really enjoyed doing this interview series, and I've been very fortunate to talk to a lot of interesting people. And in this Filmmaker in Focus episode, I was joined by artist, writer, director Emmanuel Duga to talk about his cinematic inspirations and aspirations, what it means to make a movie locally, following your dreams, and of course, his movies, Nothing Ever Happens in Burbank, California, and Jeff Gets a Job. So kick back and enjoy the interview.
This is so cool. I've never been interviewed for a podcast before.
Well, now you have.
Yeah, now I have.
Yeah. Okay. So we are live-ish. You and I are in the flesh.
Yes.
Here in Burbank, California.
Mm-hmm.
Not so sunny day today, but compared to the rest of the country, pretty good.
Yeah.
This is Filmmaker in Focus, and I'm joined by Emmanuel Duga. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure to have you, honestly. You know, part of what I like doing the most with the show is doing a lot of these, you know, filmmaker featurettes and getting to talk to people about what they're working on and their projects. I had the chance to watch both of your movies.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
And I watched the trailer for your new movie.
Yeah.
And of course, we're going to get into your movies. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to know first, though, what is your favorite bad movie?
I love this question. have you heard of Hard Ticket to Hawaii?
I have not. I feel like I need to see that now.
It's a fun time. Okay. The other one that's great to watch with a group of people would be, oh my God, it's that Roger Ebert movie, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
I saw a poster for that in your movie on the wall. Was that filmed at your own apartment? And that is your poster?
No. No. But I watched it in college, and I thought, like, I watched it with my roommate, and I was like, oh, this is one hell of a time. So, like, once I came back to Burbank during the summer, I was like, guys, like, I literally grabbed all my friends and, like, had a watch party.
Awesome. Yeah, it's kind of a cool story that, you know, Ebert was such a renowned critic for a long time.
Yeah, and that's the only movie that he ever wanted to make.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
I've got one more sort of icebreaker question for you. I want you to give me your Chris rankings. So Evans, Pine, Pratt, and Hemsworth.
Evans, Pine. Wait, say it again.
Chris Evans, Chris Pine, Chris Pratt, and Chris Hemsworth.
I think it's a battle between Hemsworth and Pine at the very top.
Fair.
Who's the other two? Who's
you got the Captain America and Star-Lord?
Chris Evans. Yeah. No, I think in terms of hotness, I'm just going to say Chris Evans at the very top. Chris Evans. Who was that? Chris Hemsworth, Pine, and then Chris, oh God, the guy from Community, right?
Yes, Chris Pratt.
Chris Pratt. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd like to get that out of the way.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, you know, we got to set the bar high. Mm-hmm. I want to know from you, though, what are your earliest film influences?
Disney.
Disney?
Yeah. I actually wanted to be a Disney animator growing up. I saw Beauty and the Beast, Peter Pan, and Cinderella in one weekend, when I was like, I don't know, 5 or 7. And I was like, that's the thing I want to do. And so I spent maybe the next 15 years of my life just learning how to draw. But I didn't realize that I actually want to become a filmmaker.
Hmm.
And I think there's this connotation in the film industry that animation is not filmmaking. So I didn't really connect the dots until like after high school. I'm like, actually, I want to become a filmmaker instead of an animator.
Yeah, there is kind of like a weird stigma around it. Like they're not in the same family.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know why that is when so many of us are raised on animated films to
begin with, you know.
It's I think it's like a psychological thing where it's just like because it's a kid's movie, so it's kind of poo-poo upon.
Yeah, that's fair.
And like, you know, one of my favorite films of all time is Beauty and the Beast, and I always look at that film in terms of story structure, and I think it's perfect. And every time I mention it to any filmmakers here in LA, it's like, oh yeah, I guess. Like, there's this certain dismissal to it.
That's interesting. Well, I guess that leads me very nicely into my next question. How did you actually get started in filmmaking?
So I was 16. I was still in high school, and I had this project in my computer science class to create a robot, and then we had to make a short film based off of it.
Okay.
And since I didn't have friends who are actors, I mean, I grew up here in LA. I went to school in Chinatown, actually. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to do some boring ass video. I'm going to like actually make something creative. So I created my very first short that I ever made in my entire life is a paper cutout of a love story about like two people in Paris, and they're giving each other gifts of like robots.
Oh, okay.
Because there's this short film by Disney called Papers. It was like about the paper airplane back in 2013, black and white. And
sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, it was. And I used the music for that, and like I learned a lot about editing, and like, you know, storytelling through just doing those paper cutouts. And then the next year, I made a fully animated short. Based on the, again, it's a school project where my teacher's like, make a trailer on a Greek god I assigned you to. I wanted it to be Apollo, but I got Hephaestus. So I was like, okay, fine, I guess I'll get that. So what I did is I took the overture from the Nine the Musical from the 80s and like yanked that onto this short and like created a musical short film based off of like the music. And so those are like my earliest experiences of filmmaking is in animation.
Oh, very, very cool. As a fellow Burbankian, I was born in Burbank. I now have returned to Burbank.
Yeah.
We are recording now in Burbank.
Yeah.
Why did you want to make Nothing Ever Happens in Burbank, California?
I wanted to show like middle class life in Los Angeles because I think when I was coming up, you know, it was like 2015, 2016, the shows that are popping up were like Riverdale and like I think Euphoria is just around the corner, and it's like this high drama, like coming of age stories where I'm like, that's not really my experience, you know. It's just like me and my friends kind of hanging out and figuring out like what to do with our lives. And also because my experience in LA isn't really about like being in Hollywood. Or like being in filmmaking, it's just like working class folks kind of like living their day to day life. And I thought that should be the movie. And also because La La Land, I saw La La Land around this time too when I first came up with the idea for the project. And I was like, that's like a white transplant idea of LA that is not like applicable to me, someone who's like a child of immigrant. Like I had very different ideas of what LA is. Should be shown on TV or on not TV on films. Like I related more to like Friday, like the,
I grew up with Friday also.
Yeah. Like that's a great movie. And I thought like I should do a version of that, but like put it here in Burbank where it's just my own neighborhood.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, obviously like, you know, I see when you're out on the streets, I see a lot of stuff. That is familiar to me, stuff that I will not mention now because they're not paying me to do so. But you went with a handheld camera and a sort of very like naturalistic, I want to say like laissez-faire approach to making that film and with the dialogue and the performances. So how do you make decisions about that and like what you want to include in the movie?
I don't know. I remember it just purely from vibes. It was just purely vibes. I just know it needed, there were like certain ideas I wanted to explore, and I did have a fully written out script, but once I got my actors to show up, I realized that some of the stuff I've written doesn't really work. So I said, let's throw out some of the script and like let's put in some new material. And it was pretty much a collaboration from the very beginning, because I just think that, you know, the people that I hired for the project knows it better. Not the material better. I know the material, but it's just, if they're going to be in it, it might as well be collaborative, because I wasn't paying anyone. It was just like, I was like, I wanted to experiment with something, and this was the experiment I put on. And yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about casting, but I mean, I think you answered that question. So this is all like friends and people that wanted to just like have the experience of doing it.
Yeah, it was like, because when I made this film, it was like 2 years out of high school, and I left LA, actually. I went to college in the Bay Area. So like, I just didn't really know anyone and wasn't really networking here. So I thought, there's this adage from Richard Linklater saying that, why don't you just make a film in your own backyard? And I'm still good with a lot of the people from my high school too. So I thought, hey, can we do this? Can we do that? And we still, at that point, we didn't really have we didn't have jobs. It was easier to get everyone to just show up.
Yeah. Like that.
Yeah.
It's hard to get people to show up in LA. So
yeah, I
mean, you managed to do that, which is half the battle.
Yeah, actually. And it wasn't hard either. It was, I think the general feeling that people had towards it was like, it's Emmanuel's passion. I've always talked about filmmaking, and they just showed up for it just because they were kind of inspired at, oh, like he's actually doing it.
No, yeah, that's awesome. Some of the dialogue in the film also reflects the sort of like, should we make plans? I have to like, let me get back to you. I need to check my schedule. It's like, it's very much like an LA attitude. But in terms of locations, like this feels kind of like a run and gun style of film. Like it's all handheld.
Yeah.
The first one. And you're obviously like out in the streets. There's some people that like sort of in the background are like, oh, am I being filmed right now?
Yeah.
Kind of. So I imagine this was an unpermitted shoot.
Yep. Very much so. Well, the other thing too is like, I did take one media production class. It was the only film class I've ever taken in college. And one of the things I learned was to learn to ask for permits or like ask permissions from like location owners or location managers. And that was great. And also looking up laws in the city.
It was smart.
Yeah. So in Burbank, at least when I was filming this, and I don't know if that's still the same ordinance now, but if you are not blocking the sidewalks and you have a camera on your shoulder, then you could pretty much film anywhere in the city. And like my sister went to Loyola Marymount, and she would tell me the complaints that the film students would have over there, which is like, ah, location's expensive in LA. And I was like, where are you filming? If you're filming in the West Side, duh, it's expensive. But if you go to the Valley, you might get away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, there's a reason, I guess, like the porn industry shot a lot in the Valley back in the heyday of porn. But, you know, it didn't look super crowded like when you were out on the streets. Like, did you plan to just go and like find times where everybody was available, or were you looking at times where, hey, like it's kind of not busy on the sidewalks out here? Because you're on Magnolia Boulevard in a lot of it. You're on Victory at one point. So it's like, you know, I live here. I know what it's like. And granted, this was what, 5 years ago?
It was 2018 when we filmed it.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Yeah,
so it was way longer.
Yeah. Like those gas prices in like one shot of the film was like $3.63. And I thought it was expensive back then. I thought, I'll take those gas prices now, please.
Well, I saw the 2020 date. And then there's a point where you're walking by Toys R Us. And I'm like, Toys R Us? I'm like, whoa, this... I was like, I have no idea what time we're in. But, you know, there's an interesting quality to it that it feels... It's got like a timeless nature to it. Like there's very little use of people sort of unnecessarily being on their cell phones. So you kind of... It could be dropped into like the 70s or the 80s. Like it kind of feels like high school kids on a day off
kind
of thing throughout much of it. And you have these intersecting character stories. So it's like, it's kind of like an anthology, but it's almost like, it reminds me of, I would say like the six-way stop in Beverly Hills that gives people nightmares when you pull up and you don't know which stop sign is going first.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about, by the Beverly Hills Hotel. How did you plot out what you wanted to do with the characters that you put into that first film?
Well, it was very simple. I was inspired a lot by like the stories or like common experiences that my friends would have. Like quite literally, I would pull out like text messages and turn it into dialogue. I don't know. I I think it was just like the emotional truth of the scene. They were just just thinking right now. The one that I remember distinctly was the scene in the car with me and my friend Jeff, where we're talking about him leaving school. That was like an actual conversation I had with him. And so and I did theater in high school, so like I had some experience with acting and like watching my director directing. And one thing that I learned a lot from him was like, it's always about the emotional truth. So if the actors don't feel it, then no one else is going to feel it. So like that was the thing that I was more concerned about as we were filming. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. You know, I think what I was getting at was just there's a lot of like interwoven stories. It's not like a story that follows a single character. Like there are through lines that connect all the way through to the end.
Yeah.
But you'll be following one character and sort of like the baton gets passed to somebody else walking on the street. There's a philosophical, well, a theological debate going on, walking up with a guy in his bathrobe, walking down the street. So like when you wanted to include something like that, like how do you frame that in the context of the story that you want to tell?
Vibes, what felt right. I just, because it doesn't have a plot. I mean, it has a plot. Like, there's little plots here and there, but it's just, I remember when I was writing it, it felt right for that moment. And it was like following, tracking along the day itself. And it was just vibes. It was, it's not a very intelligent answer, but it is.
Hey, look, vibes filmmaking is a thing.
Yeah.
For people that don't believe in it, it 100% is.
I mean, because my biggest inspiration for this film is Slacker by Richard Linklater. Yeah. And it was like, even if you ask him that question, I think the only through line he had was like the last film that he made before Slacker. He needs to show up at the very beginning of the film and the rest could just be whatever. And I thought, that was like such a simple way to like make a movie, and I thought I ran with that idea.
And how easy was it to make that movie?
Very easy. I'm comfortable with ensemble storytelling, and I'm also comfortable with like storytelling that doesn't really go along with the three act structure, which is kind of like a big thing here in LA. So I remember when I started showing the script around people, they're like, oh, this is like a really bad script. There's no story here. It's not a three-act structure. And I said, why should there be? Like, I think there are many ways to tell a story. And Sire kind of gave me that permission to just kind of run with it, you know?
Were you shopping it to try to get it produced? Or just like looking for funding?
I was attempting to, but I just didn't know how to achieve that. So. Fair. And I was like 21, 22, and I was going to a business school. I just didn't know anyone, you know? Yeah. So one thing that I did for this film was like, if I could make this for $0, how am I going to execute this? And thankfully, someone actually gave me money halfway through pre-production where I only had like $1,000 to work from. And most of that went to sound.
Yeah. It's the little things that you don't see that go on behind the scenes that really suck up the budget. Well, speaking of sound, at the end of the film, you know, it fades to black, all the characters are walking off, and then you hear the bells toll in the background.
Yeah.
And I'm like, these are kind of like ominous bells for that moment. I'm like, they sound like sort of like church bells. Like they're powerful bells.
Yeah.
And so I started to ask myself, like, does really nothing happen in Burbank?
That's the question.
It's quiet here, but like literally every night I hear like silence. So there's something happening. It's just not happening like on the street that I live on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was the question I asked myself when I left LA again for this, because I came back for the summer. I filmed this film and I went back to college. And I thought to myself, I don't know what I was complaining about. Burbank is fine.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was complaining about. So. The bells, we filmed that scene at Water Village because that's where one of my friends lived. And, there's a church there and I thought it would be a great way to kind of mark us kind of getting to the next chapter by just like us getting older. And I thought, why not? It's like a church bell. It's not. And but I'm glad that this kind of brought like an existential thought to you about like, oh, does nothing ever happen in Burbank, or does something happen here?
Well, because that film ends on a note where the characters are—they're going to get beer, I think, right?
And pies.
Sorry, they're going to get pies.
Yeah.
Someone, I think, maybe had agreed to get beer in that conversation.
Yeah.
And so they're all walking off, even though you drove up in your car.
Yeah.
So people that don't know, like, yes, House of Pies or Republic of Pie was there on the corner of, like, Franklin and Vermont.
Yeah.
So, like, it is walking distance if you live in Atwater Village. But if you don't know that, then it's like, okay, maybe they're going, like, down to the liquor store or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think part of it was, like, I watched all these characters have, like, a day in the life kind of moment with all of them. And they all have their own sort of like dreams and aspirations, and you have like a young actress who wants to like get into the industry.
Yeah.
You have another guy who's like very fixated on his job. I don't even remember what his job was. I don't even know if it's mentioned in the movie at the time.
It was like being a PA on set, but it's just like kind of, you know, it's a toss away thing. Yeah.
So like you have all these characters that I think, I mean, for me, I'm 41.
Yeah.
So I look at these characters. It's like, they're all young. They all have like their hopes and their dreams and their lives ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the movie does communicate a lot of that throughout sort of the process of getting to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you made what you told me was a sequel.
Yeah.
But it's not called Something Actually Does Happen in Burbank. It's called Jeff Gets a Job.
Yeah.
And so whether it's a sequel or a spiritual sequel, you have a lot of the same actors.
Yeah, basically.
You have a lot of the same character names.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that it, at the very least, is a spiritual sequel. Like, did you write it and intend it to be, like, this is what happened after the events of the first film?
Basically, yeah. Mm. But I did, there was this filmmaker in France. His name is Jacques Demy. He did Umbrella Cherbourg, Youngers of Rochefort. And I like this idea of a cinematic world where you start with one movie and the next movie we follow one of the characters from that one movie. It doesn't have to be the main character, just a character in that universe.
Yeah.
And then, but when we go to the next movie, it's a completely different film. It can stand on its own and you could watch it without the context of the previous movie. And so that's where that idea came from. But I remember when I was coming up with the idea, I wanted to write a movie that reflects where I was at post-production of Burbank. And I felt like when I finished Burbank, it's like, that's not me anymore. Like, I feel like I'm a lot closer to kind of figuring out where I need to go next in what with my life. Because the characters in Burbank are like, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah. I mean, granted, you're like, what, 20 when you're making that?
Yeah, so, 21, 22.
I mean, we've all been there.
Yeah. But when Jeff Gets a Job, I was like towards the end of college, and I was like, oh, like there's like stuff I have to do as an adult. But then it's like very confusing. I thought that should be the next film.
Yeah, I mean, adulthood is, it never gets less confusing. That's all I can tell you.
That's what I heard.
Like it just stays, and you get more comfortable in your own skin, though. And
yes.
I think that's probably the best part of it. And, you know, as a younger man, it was like, oh, I don't want to be 30. I don't want to be in my 30s. My 30s were great.
Yeah.
Well, the second half of my 30s, I should say. Most of my 30s, actually, were great. Now that I'm in my 40s, I'm like, my 40s are great, too. I feel like I know myself better. I'm doing more of the things that I want to do.
Yeah.
But
I just turned 30 this year, by the way.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Happy big 30 then.
Yeah.
but, like, there is a universal sort of thread that I think, like, the process of growing up and like realizing that each sort of stage of your life that you reach is like, there's not really like a playbook for it.
No.
And like it constantly keeps changing.
Yeah.
The things that you thought you maybe wanted, you don't want anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that's happened to me a bunch of times.
Yeah. I think this was like when I was 19, Meryl Streep said something where she said, like, what makes you happy 5 years ago will not make you happy 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Our happiness is like a goal that we kind of work towards, but it's always going to change depending on the needs that you need for now. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, like, I shouldn't have happiness as like a set thing. It's more like, a moving goalpost, you know. I guess I'm not too pessimistic about turning 30 or just like growing older. I just know that it is going to be like whatever I need for the next 5 years that will make me happy, you know, kind of thing.
Hey, that's a healthy attitude, right? I mean, yeah. When you set those benchmarks for yourself that you don't end up achieving, it's like, oh, am I failing at this thing that I'm supposed to be doing?
Yeah.
And there isn't like a supposed to. I think that's...
That's an imposed thing on us, really.
Yeah, yeah. It is. And I think when you get to the time that you're making the second movie, what year is that?
When I filmed it, it was 2022.
22. So 4 years after...
The first one, yeah.
At the beginning of the film, both of them start with these like sort of longer like musical overtures.
Yeah.
And so like, how do you make the decision of, hey, I want to include like music in the opening here, and this mm-hmm. is what I want to actually like do with the music? Because in one, you get kind of like a snapshot of all of the things happening in LA that are not Burbank, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like Angelinos, we'll pick up on that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, this is the beach. That's not Burbank, right? That's downtown. That's not Burbank. Yeah, it's Chinatown, Koreatown. That's not Burbank.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. And then in the second film, the first scene isn't music, but like the second scene is set to music with Jeff like walking after picking up Thai food or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So like, how did you sort of go from what you wanted to do with the first one and sort of like that musical collage to sort of this like long tracking shot with Jeff?
Well, that one came from The Graduate. I wanted to kind of have a callback to The Graduate. And if I had the money, I would have put Sounds of Silence.
Not getting the licensing on that for cheap.
Yeah, no, not at all. But I know that Scarborough Fair is in public domain. And I thought, well, time to kind of use it, honestly. And like, at least no one really picked it up at all. Like whenever they watched this movie, we never really hear Jeff's internal thoughts. And I thought that should be the only time we ever hear his internal thoughts is just the music that he's kind of lost. And because we have a cultural understanding of The Graduate.
Yeah.
And I thought that would be a best way to shorthand basically like what Jeff is thinking.
Oh, interesting. I noticed also from the first to the second film, you dropped most of the Steadicam. Like you went mostly stationary shots in the second film.
Mm.
And I feel like I saw a kind of natural progression from the kind of shots that you selected for the first film to the shot selection for the second film with like the framing and sort of like just your progression as a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so you did use Steadicam. Or you used handheld at one point for one scene. But that scene is a little bit hectic. They're playing beer pong. They're smoking weed, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like it matches tonally better. So now that like you're at this point, like 3 years later from this, and you can look back at both of the films, like when you watch them, do you see the stuff that you want to change going into the next film? Like, can you look at that and be like, okay, this is what I did here and here, and this is what I want to do beyond that?
No, not really. I mean, there's only like maybe one shot in the entire Burbank film that I want to change, but that's about it. I'm that kind of artist where I'm like, when it's done, or when it's done, it's just done. Like I can't really do much, and like I'm really happy with the work, and a lot of the ideas I had about like how to shoot the film is coming out of necessity and out of experimentation. Where for Burbank, it was like, oh, I wanted to make it feel like a documentary where it's like blending narrative and fiction, because a lot of the stuff that we say on film is actually pretty close to our real lives. Where I don't know, there's something about blending documentary and fiction that's kind of appealing to me at that period. And then with Jeff Gets a Job, I was a lot more deliberate with like still shots because I was inspired by Jim Jarmusch, Stranger Than Paradise.
Okay.
And like that walking sequence at the beginning of the movie, that was also a callback to Paris, Texas, because they filmed it on that same street. Because they filmed it in Burbank too, actually.
Wow. Did not know that.
Yeah, they actually did film it in Burbank, and I was like, I know that street. Like, my friend lives close by.
Look at that. Some stuff actually does happen in Burbank.
Yeah. So, yeah, but for the most part, I was I was going after like Jim Jarmusch because it was so magical to watch like Stranger Than Paradise, and it was only had 66 cuts in the entire movie. It's like 90 minutes long. I was like, can I replicate that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said for a 90-minute film. Love me a 90-minute movie.
Yeah. But, like, only for 66 cuts the entire time, whereas, like, mostly, like, one frame. There's no coverage. Like, that was brilliant.
Yeah, there's definitely some older films that use, like, a much more, like, wide-shot approach.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's not, like, the focal length just kind of like, keeps everything in frame. And yeah, so yeah. It's, like, your eyes kind of moving all over the place. It's much more, like, experimental, less, like, narrative-driven style.
Yeah. I don't recommend it, though.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, do what you want as a filmmaker. But, but like, you know, my background in animation, like, allowed me to, like, storyboard the entire thing and actually animate it. So, like, I know it will work once I start filming it. But for everyone else, like, I don't recommend it if you're, like, not ballsy enough or confident enough to, like, pull something off like that. So...
Well, when we were talking, speaking of narrative stuff, you chose Jeff as the guy that is the focal point of the second film. We still see a lot of the sort of the narratives from the other characters kind of like weaving their way back in. You know, we catch up with Austin, who's now selling like dick rejuvenation. Why did you want to use Jeff for that?
Well, Jeff is my muse.
I was going to ask, that is literally a question in my notes later was, is Jeff your muse? Because he's also the actor in your upcoming film, right?
Yes, that is a question that, which I have a producer for my next film now, but like that was a question he asked me, like, are you sure you want to have Jeff or get a well-known actor? And I was like, no, it's Jeff. Like, it has to be Jeff.
Good, stand up for your guy.
Yeah. Well, Jeff is really good at like very subtle movement in front of the camera. Like in terms of like his facial, you know, movements and stuff like that. And I don't know, he, as an actor, I feel like I need to lean in to kind of watch what Jeff is doing. And, and Jeff surprises me as an actor because I thought, oh, like there's going to be a limitation because he's never trained in acting. He's never like has any interest in it, but then like, it would always surpass like whatever I've given him. And one of the first short I gave him was like a very talky short. And even then, like he was struggling a little bit, but he's not bad in it. And out of all the actors I've worked with up to this point in my career, he's the only one who's able to kind of match exactly how I hear the words in my head. And there's, it's music to my ears. And he has a great look to him. Like I think, I've told this, to him in person that he kind of reminds me of Alain Delon sometimes. But I could be biased, you know, like other people might say like, no, I don't know.
How long have you known Jeff?
We've known each other since high school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So a while now.
It's been a while. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a, no, it's a good long relationship, especially like, when you're going to be working on things together. So that familiarity is definitely a kind of shorthand that is going to come in handy.
Yeah. It's very much a shorthand. And the other thing too is like, I cannot imagine anyone else to play Jeff but Jeff, because there's a certain specificity that Jeff brings to the role where if I don't know, like I may be bashing actors, but like if I were to give this to just any other actor in LA, they would have played it too depressed, too self-pitying. But Jeff kind of strikes this balance where like, yeah, he's kind of down, but also he's not like, you know, he has like a lot of dignity and self-respect about himself that kind of shines through. And I want that for Jeff because, you know, he's aware that he's kind of in this situation, but he doesn't really know what to do next. And I think a lot of us are just kind of in that spot, you know?
Yeah. It's that kind of like choice paralysis of where like, he knows he needs to do something. Not quite sure what that is.
Yeah.
You know, he spends a lot of his day hanging out, talking to people, goes to party, meet people. Speaking of, one of those scenes, he meets a young woman at a bar, and she compliments his shoelaces. Has anyone ever complimented your shoelaces?
No.
No? Well, no. They should.
That was improv, I think, on the day off. That was like, That was brilliant. I didn't even know that was happening until like I got the footage back.
I was like, that's an interesting pickup line there. Nice shoelaces, buddy.
Can I tell you that that scene was actually somewhat autobiographical to me, where I did meet a girl named Jenny at a bar, and I was there with a friend, and I was like, my friend sits here and Jenny was there, and I was like talking to her about animation, and we ended up switching seats, and I was like, I think after that conversation, I was like, oh, I'm putting that in a movie. But it is, I'm grabbing a lot of stuff from life for the most part.
Yeah, and I mean, I think like, what is it? Art reflects life.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to sort of tell the stories that like you feel.
Yeah.
Right. And speaking of which, there's a scene where playing Ultimate Frisbee in the park, or I mean, it's been a while, but I know it as Ultimate Frisbee, and it looks like a lot of fun on screen. And it brought me back to a time where I could play Ultimate Frisbee in the park and not have to worry about like hurting my back or like tearing my ACL or something like that. Yeah. I stopped playing basketball when I was 35 and I was like, I think I'm done at this point.
Oh no.
But it was fun and it felt like this sort of like carefree release, sort of like it reminded me of like, oh, the end of the summer right before you're going back to school.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me. The music playing over it, I think, like really helps with that.
Yeah.
Do you view yourself as like a carefree filmmaker?
No, I don't think so. But I think my films kind of give off that essence because most of my films up to this point are just hangout films.
Yeah.
But like I put a lot of thought in like what I want to put on screen, and I think there's this misconception about like hangout movies, like you just grab a camera and just go and like film it. But like I don't do that. I kind of hate that approach because like I find that chaotic. Like I kind of want
to. If it were only that easy, to just like, pick up a camera and go.
Like I'd like to know what I'm editing after the shoot, you know? Because like if I don't, I'm like, one of my, what is this? You know,
do you do a lot of takes?
Not really. Not especially not with Jeff, because I only filmed that film for 10 days and 6 hours at a time.
Wow, that's a short shoot.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a lot of money, and I made a deal with the crew because Jeff had a job, like. My friend Jeff has an actual job.
Jeff has a job is the sequel to Jeff Gets a Job.
Yeah, well, we're making... It's kind of a meme now in my friend group, honestly. Yeah. Jeff has a job that summer while we're filming Jeff Gets a Job. And then, like, everybody else that were freelance that I hired on set, those were the ones I was paying. And they had, like, rates where I'm like, I can't afford that for, like, 10 days of shoots. So I thought, let's do it for 6 hours. And since the film is mostly on, like, a single, like, coverage, like we could kind of get away with it. And I think a lot of this film is just kind of out of necessity for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, look, necessity filmmaking I don't think is a bad thing.
No,
I mean, I think what is the saying, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So I think there is something like inherently creative about like you need to figure something out, like your back's against the wall, you just gotta get it done.
Yeah,
so that it sometimes like sometimes puts you in a bind.
Yeah.
But I think creatively it gives you freedom as well because you're like, look, we're going to get what we're going to get. And we just have to like live with that.
Yeah.
Like you can't be a perfectionist.
No.
To like the nth degree because you've got to move on when you only got 6 hours.
Yeah. I think like for Jeff, it was like mostly one or two takes because what I would also do with the actors is like, I would ask them come to the house at this time after work, and then we'd rehearse. And you know, with Jeff, with my friend Jeff, like I think we rehearsed the entire film for like 3 months. So like by the time we get on set, it was just like one or two takes.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, and Jeff lives in Burbank, and I live in Burbank. It was easy for us to just like meet up like after work.
Super convenient. There is a extended bit of dialogue in this film about fellatio and grapefruits. And look, call me old-fashioned. I know I'm in my 40s, so maybe I'm old, but I have never heard of this before.
The grapefruit method?
The grapefruit method.
Have you seen Girls Trip with Jada Pinkett Smith?
Yes, I have.
It was in that movie.
Gotcha, okay. Yeah. I'm going to have to go back and watch that.
But I think it's been on the internet since the early 2000s.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of it until Girls Trip. And then I got reminded again because originally the dialogue for this scene wasn't the one that ended up on on the film itself. It was completely basic. And then my friend Martin, who was Jeff's scene partner in that scene, was like, let's make something new. So we threw it out, and then he mentioned grapefruit and was like, fantastic, just put it in. And like, okay, like I have a funny story. We were actually at a Beverly Hills restaurant because Jeff's friend worked there. So we got a discount on our meal. And we were eating, and we're talking like, you know, just sucking dick. Sorry, I did the motion. So it was
it's
fun.
Recorded.
Yeah, I know, right? It's okay. But we were like kind of doing that at this like high-skilled Beverly Hills restaurant, and the couple right next to us was like, moved to the next table and like told us like, it's just like a little drafty over here. And then Jeff leaned over, it's like they moved because we were talking about blowjobs.
You know, it's not Beverly Hills lunch banter to be talking about giving head.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you shoot the movie in Burbank.
Yeah.
So you said Jeff has a job while you're shooting this, right?
Yeah.
I'm watching the movie. Like, does he get a job? Because I know the movie's called Jeff Gets a Job.
Yeah,
we see him walk into Pickwick, which my sister works at, by the way.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, I know he, like, I can put two and two together.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But, like, the last scene that we see him talking to someone, like, about the job, he still says that he's looking.
Yeah.
Right? So does he get a job? Does he work at Pickwick at the end of that story?
Do you think he works?
Well, I assume so, because he's showering and then riding to work, and he looks depressed that he has to go to work, is what I'm going to say. He's like looking out the window like, oh, yeah, I know I needed a job, but now I have a job, and I kind of just like hanging out better.
Yeah, I mean,
don't we all?
Don't we all? I mean, I'm glad that you're asking that question, because I wanted the ending to be ambiguous. Like, you figure out.
I was like, you guys are playing pool there quite a lot. So I was like, maybe he's just going to go shoot some pool.
Yeah, yeah. Or like a date. I think there were some people who were like uncomfortable with the ambiguousness of it all.
Yeah.
But I was like, no, it's like, you know, why should I give you all the answers? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, ambiguity in filmmaking is fine. But, you know, I had sort of asked, like, if Jeff is your muse, you acknowledged as much. I saw the trailer for the new film, and he's playing a vampire, and that's quite a leap, I would say, from what we've seen from you so far. So when going from the mundanity of life in Burbank to now a eternal being who is about to go eat somebody,
I
assume.
Yeah, yeah.
At least one person, I hope.
Should I tell you the pitch for that film?
Sure.
So the pitch for The Stranger is about a vampire who's never fallen in love and falls in love for the first time.
No. Oh.
And spends an entire night talking to this woman that he met at a bar that rejected him first at a club. And then he goes out at night just to kind of people watch, like somewhere in downtown LA. And then she shows up and is like, hey, I recognize you at the bar. Let's talk. And they just talk the entire night. And then like the movie kind of ends deciding whether or not he'll kill her or not.
All right. Well, I mean, that's going to be a lot easier to shoot when you only got one long dialogue scene, right?
Yeah, it's I was inspired by a French film called My Night at Maud's, and there was this 45-minute sequence where it's like they're just talking about Pascal's wager and Catholicism. And I thought, we'll replace that about something else. Yeah. But I like the idea of like two people just talking the entire night.
Yeah, it's like there is a weird kind of need in, maybe it's modern film or maybe it's just like from the consumer, to like the fact that like the notion that you need to have something happen in order to make something worthwhile. And I saw something recently, I can't remember where exactly, but it was about when you're making a film or when you're shooting something on film, connecting to the sort of boring quotes, everyday life kind of thing, may take you out of the realm of like that sort of like action and beat driven storytelling, but it connects with people who are like, yeah, my life is not like this exciting thing, but it says that there's value in sort of the everyday stuff. And I think that there is. I mean, that's where most of us live, right? Like, sure, the movies are escapism a lot of the time, and that's a fun element of it. Yeah. Like, sure, let me go watch Jason Statham be a beekeeper or a mechanic or a mob boss or whatever. He's going to beat someone's ass, right?
Yeah.
And I enjoy that in filmmaking. Yeah. But also something like, since you mentioned Linklater, his trilogy with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, right?
That was my inspiration for The Stranger, too.
There you go. So, like, that kind of stuff where it's, like, really it's just, like, this long conversation about life and love and those movies.
It's so,
like,
magical, honestly. Yeah, like,
that's a great trilogy. So when you maybe sense, like, trends happening, right, like, how much are you influenced by like what's going on now? Because it seems like a lot of your influences are coming from films of the past and from other countries.
Well, I don't care much about trends.
Good.
Because so in my marketing class, I love my marketing class in college. My marketing teacher said, like, if you like the thing that you like it unapologetically. Because if you like someone else will like it. It's just a matter of finding the right audience to connect to the thing that you're selling or the thing that you like. And like after hearing that from her, I was like, I don't really need to kind of follow what Hollywood has to say. Like, you know, I was thinking about my alumni at my college, Ryan Coogler. Like, he also went to business school in that same college. And
and he's doing just fine.
He's just doing just fine. And he's like, and like Sinner's not like a typical like vampire movie.
And not a typical Hollywood movie, really.
Not at all. And I thought, well, if he's doing that, like why can I not do that? Because most of the remarks I've gotten from people, especially when I'm showing my script around town, would be like, well, you can't do that because you're not Tarantino yet. Can't do that because you're not Linklater. It's like, well, when do I get to be Emmanuel Duda?
Those guys were nobodies when you know they wanted to do that thing.
Yeah. And so for me, I'm like, I'm just gonna be my own freak and just like write the stuff that I genuinely find interesting.
I mean, look, music to my ears, because one of the things that, you know, we do on the show is celebrate loving the thing that you love unapologetically, because you don't have to, you know,
I don't have
apologize
to
apologize for it.
Yeah.
You know, so I love hearing that from you. I also want to know, as a filmmaker now, like, what are you hoping that you accomplish on your artistic journey? I mean, we talked about sort of not necessarily setting benchmarks, but now that you've got a couple under your belt, you're working on another one.
Actually, two.
Look at that.
The other one that I don't have a trailer for is it's called Off the Clock. It's basically Ferris Bueller, but women. And skipping a day of work.
No, that's fun.
Which is completely different energy from like from The Stranger, which is basically American Psycho, but mixed with Before Sunrise. Completely different tones, but I love it.
So do you see the future of where you want to go with filmmaking? Like, are there different things that you want to try in terms of like maybe techniques or like equipment stuff?
I really don't want to pigeonhole myself at any genres. Like Stephen Sondheim said, content is the form. So like, for example, if I want to, let me rethink that. I just don't want to be pigeonholed. I want to have the freedom that other filmmakers have, like Linklater. Like, he's doing like, you know, action. He's doing, you know, like art house or like just studio, like anything really. Because at the end of the day, I want to get I went into filmmaking just because I want to kind of try things out. Just wanted to see, like, can I pull this off? So my biggest dream really in filmmaking is to do a musical.
Yeah.
Because I have like a really not wild take, but it's a take. I think the true test of a director is being able to direct a musical, because there's so much elements that is at play that if you can't pull it off, I'm like, well, good try, I guess. But my next big thing in filmmaking for me, like the thing that I'm more interested about is distribution.
Yeah. Well, right now, Nothing Ever Happens in Burbank, California is streaming on Fossum TV.
Yes.
So you can just go to Fossum TV, search, and it's right there available. It's rentable on
Amazon Prime.
Amazon. Okay. I think it was like $2.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that much.
Yeah, yeah.
You can afford it.
Support a local young filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. How much of that $2 do you see on that rental?
I don't know. So far I've only earned $8.
Okay.
on the film. But I do better when I actually film it theatrically. Like I've done like in-person screenings and I've earned
nice ticket sales. Yeah.
Yeah, the most money when I do it theatrically, you know. And I think so far in terms of box office, I've earned maybe $500 on, so like maybe a third of the budget already.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Well, when you look at the people that are going to, or when you envision the people that are going to watch your movie,
uh-huh.
What is the thing that you want them to be taking away from your work?
Oh. Well, the first thing that popped into my head right now that it's possible to make, like, to do the art that you want to make. The second that, you know, to hear my voice, to not be invisible, especially in this industry where, like, if you're not connected or if you're not white, like, what are you then, you know? And I got into some problems with a couple of colleagues or friends of mine when I was making Jeff Gets a Job, because they kind of called it as dishonest because I wasn't writing about my Filipino experience. And I was like, no, like, this is honest. Like, this is my thoughts and feelings about, like, the spirit of my life. And I just want them to kind of see it for what it is instead of, like, being meaning behind it.
Yeah. Like, are you only allowed to write about what it's like to be Filipino at that point?
Yeah, exactly. It's, but for the most part, to just see me as me, not any put upon labels. Because, like,
no. You know,
the whole point of, like, creating films for me is, like, I want to play. It is just play at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a healthy attitude for it. And look, if you're going to watch his movie, then, you know, embrace the sandbox and know that you too can play. And have some fun. Emmanuel, this has been a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Well, can I
please do?
Can I plug something?
And plug what you want.
Oh, yeah.
That's what was coming next.
Yeah. Oh, I just want to make sure. I want to make sure. What you call that? I'm actually doing another screening of Jeff Gets a Job because I did screen it last year. And I've been in talks at the moment with two theaters here in SoCal. So, like, be on the loop. Sign up for my newsletter at PressIntenseFilms.com, and I hope that he'll put that in the notes. So yeah,
any links that you need will be in the show notes, where they always are. Just you can message me those links.
Oh, and yeah, I will include them. As you can tell, this is my first time doing podcasts. I don't know.
Well, it's the first time I've done it live and in person. So, I mean, thank you for being a guinea pig.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure, seriously. Yes. And will you do me one favor? Look at the camera and say, I'm Emmanuel Duga, and this is Bad Movies We Love.
Hi, my name is Emmanuel Duga, and this is Bad Movies We Love.
Awesome.
Clap.
And we're out. Thanks for joining us for this spotlight session right here on Bad Movies We Love. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to follow the show, leave us a review, and share it with your fellow movie lovers. Thanks to Emmanuel for coming on the show and for talking about his career, his hopes as a filmmaker, and what it's like to work with friends and do things locally. You know, I've been doing this for a while now, and it's not every day that I meet a filmmaker who essentially lives in the same neighborhood as I do. So it was really cool to touch base and to talk about Burbank-specific stuff. You can find Emmanuel on Instagram at ManManDuga, as well as Official Burbank Movie, which you can catch on Amazon Prime right now. And make sure to check out Present Tense Films, where you can get updates about all of his upcoming projects. Links for that will be up in the show notes. And while you're there, make sure you check out the rest of the Scheist Podcast Network at scheistpodnet.captivate.fm. And until next time, stay curious and take care.